War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome back to another episode of Key Battles of the War of 1812. This is your host, James Early, as always. And once again, I am joined by my good buddy, Steve Guerra. How are you doing this morning, Steve?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on again. I can't wait to talk about this one.
Yes, this episode is going to show just how determined the Americans are. We saw two episodes ago how the U.S. Army launched a three-pronged invasion of Canada. And they were 0-3, basically. Strike one, strike two, strike three. They were out. Tried again a little bit later, and that one didn't really go anywhere either. Now we're going into the year 1813, and the Americans are going to kind of clean house a little bit and give it the old college try again. So, Steve, what do you think? Where should we go? How should we start?
I guess maybe talk about, because some of our leaders, and the last time we left, General Hull is sitting in a corner with tobacco juice dribbling out of his mouth. Who are some of the people who come along and step up after some of our other generals fall?
All right. Well, compared to 1812, by 1813, the American military situation was much better for several reasons. Changes were made. Starting at the top, President Madison got rid of the Secretary of War, William Eustace, and Navy Secretary Hamilton. Even though the Navy had done well in 1812, he figured, let's try some new people. And we got better leaders at the very top, the civilian leaders of the Army and Navy. So William Armstrong becomes Secretary of War, and William Jones becomes Secretary of the Navy. We also saw this had actually happened in late 1812, that our beloved General Hull, he's going to be permanently sidelined. He'll get to go dribble tobacco out of his mouth in the comfort of his own home instead of being shot at. He's replaced by William Henry Harrison, a much younger man, much more aggressive man in the Northwest. And in addition to Harrison's appointment in the old Northwest, we have some younger commanders coming up through the ranks, people like Winfield Scott, Jacob Brown, Zebulon Pike, and eventually Andrew Jackson. They're going to be rising up to take positions of command. Again, younger men, not as experienced as people like William Hull and Henry Dearborn and those older people that we talked about in the last episode, but nevertheless, younger, aggressive, and more talented leaders. Also, the men in the ranks were better. Those who had fought in the 1812 campaigns were now seasoned veterans. The veterans were joined by thousands of new recruits, and by the spring of 1813, there were about 30,000 men in the Army.
I was shocked about some of these people, like Zebulon Pike. I didn't know much about him, and we might get into him later, but that guy shoved a lot of living into a very short life. Not to give away too much. He won't have too much life left after this, but.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Yeah, Pike had, of course, gone his famous expedition of discovery and discovered the peak that is named after him, Pike's Peak. And now he is a War of 1812 general. And we're going to see he's going to be a very aggressive, very offensive-minded general. All right.
We had in our last time that we talked about what was going on in the old Northwest and in the inland campaign of this three-prong attack. What's the Americans' 2.0 plan, you might call it, going into 1813?
Yeah, take two. Well, once again, Upper Canada will be the primary target for the 1813 campaigns. Quebec was this dangling jewel, this prize that they really wanted, but it was considered too heavily fortified to attack. And even Montreal was set aside as a target, at least for now. So Secretary of War Armstrong's plan was to retake the Northwest, to push the British out of the Niagara region, and to destroy the British naval bases on Lake Ontario. Those are at Kingston and York. But for the campaign to succeed, the Americans would have to gain control of the Great Lakes, especially Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. Those were critical. But since the beginning of the war, the British had controlled both lakes. The British had 5 ships on Lake Ontario and 4 on Lake Erie. The Americans only had one on each lake. Secretary of the Navy Jones put Captain Isaac Chauncey in command of American naval forces on the lakes. Chauncey inaugurated a shipbuilding effort on both lakes. So we're, and the British are going to be building some ships as well. So we kind of get into an arms race. Let's talk about Chauncey real quick. He's going to be a key figure throughout the war. He was born in Connecticut in 1772. He joined the Navy in 1798. And like many of the naval commanders we have discussed and will discuss later, he had served in the Quasi-War and the Barbary Wars. He had also served as Commandant of the New York Naval Shipyard from 1807 to 1813. So he knew a lot about building ships. Isaac Chauncey played a prominent role in the creation of the Navy Yard.
It's really, I think it's hard to realize if you've never been to the Great Lakes that they are huge. And it really is more of an ocean-going kind of battle or seamanship than it is a lake. It's not your pond in your backyard or even in a lot of places, the biggest lake, if you've never seen them. I mean, they are the biggest lakes in North America, and they're in a lot of ways even more challenging than sailing in the ocean because there's no tide, which tides often help ocean going ships, sailing ships get around, and the weather changes in an instant. So that both the British and the Americans really have their work cut out for them going into these naval battles on the lakes.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you said, these are mini oceans in a way. So it's going to be a challenge. There's so much space to cover. It's going to be a challenge for each side to dominate the entire lake. All right, any other thoughts on this, or shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. Let's maybe talk about the northwestern frontier. What's going on over there? It's not completely calm down there.
No, it's not. We saw in our last episode, two episodes ago, when we discussed the land war, that the American attack into Upper Canada across the Detroit River had totally failed, ending up in actually the British coming over into the U.S. and taking over Detroit and occupying a good chunk of what is now the state of Michigan. So General Harrison's job is to try to get it back. So he ordered the construction of a strong fort on the Maumee Rapids. It was named Fort Meigs after the governor of Ohio. And in late April, recently promoted British Major General Proctor, we met him last time as Colonel Proctor. He had replaced the charismatic and talented General Brock, who had been killed in 1812. General Proctor led 1,000 regulars and militia toward Fort Meigs. And on the way, they were joined by 1,200 native warriors under Tecumseh. Our old friend Tecumseh is back, and he wants revenge. He wants blood. On May 1st, the British began an artillery barrage of the fort, but the barrage did little damage to the fort's earthen walls. The defenders dug out about 1,000 rounds and fired them back at the British. I get a kick out of that. These forts, instead of being made out of like bricks or something, which would just shatter when they were hit by a cannonball, they were largely made of dirt. And so a cannonball would land in it and just kind of go thunk and do nothing, do no damage. And then they would just dig them out and fire it right back. On the 5th, of May, American General Green Clay arrived with a 1,200-man force from Kentucky. They attacked the British on the west side of the Maumee. At the same time, another force left the fort and attacked the British on the east side of the river. And in this battle, known as the Battle of Fort Meigs, the Kentuckians achieved surprise, but they soon became overextended, and they suffered 50% casualties. That's a very high percentage. The Indians killed many prisoners before Tecumseh ordered them to stop. The surviving Americans returned to the fort. And this is one of the battles where they were crying out, "Remember the Raisin." The Raisin had been the site of an American loss and a massacre of some of their wounded men at the hands of some of the Native Americans. And so in this, these Kentuckians, as I said, were charging into battle. They were crying, "Remember the Raisin." And Alan Taylor very wittily says, quote, "Clay's men should have forgotten the Raisin," end quote. So they were just a little too gung-ho to avenge their fallen comrades. After the battle, most of the Indians, realizing the fort could not be taken, left in search of plunder. In addition, many Canadian militia returned home. With his force now greatly reduced, Proctor ended the siege on May 9th and returned to Canada. Interesting to see that it's not just American militia that don't want to go on foreign expeditions. The Canadian militia also didn't have much of an appetite for fighting in the U.S. And on August 1st, Proctor led a mixed British and Indian force to attack Fort Stevenson, which is east of Fort Meigs. The British had to attack without the Indians, who refused to participate. The assault failed and Proctor returned to Canada.
So the Kentuckians, they counterattacked the British who were attacking an American fort. Is that what happened?
Exactly.
And it was a failure, but the British had to wind up withdrawing because their militia decided they had enough.
Right. They lost the militia and they lost quite a few of the natives that they had fighting with them as well. So
that all sounds very familiar.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard enough to get the regular army to fight well. Although I should say the British regular army was very, very good and the Americans are getting better. But yeah, that's just this policy of relying on militia. Other auxiliaries really comes back to bite both sides.
What do you think Tecumseh's motivations were to not kill injured prisoners and to be a little bit more chivalrous, you might say? Was it just that personally he was a stand-up guy, or did he have a political or a diplomatic motivation for that?
Well, I think that he did have a political motivation. Remember that he was originally from a part of the country that is technically American soil. You know, it's part of the United States. And I think he was hoping to not burn his bridges with the Americans. And so that maybe one day there might be some kind of settlement that could be reached to where there would be a place for him and his people to live without white encroachment. That would be my guess. I don't know for sure. I'm not a big expert on Tecumseh, but that, based on what I have read, I think that would be the reason.
So now we've got that battle in the U.S. side, and we're going to shift over to another battle on the Canadian side. What was the importance of this Battle of the Thames?
Okay, so this is a major battle. I will say just one other thought on the last one. It was kind of a stalemate. As we saw, neither side really won a clear victory, but the fact that the British had to retreat from the field and return back to Canada kind of made the Americans feel like it was a victory. So now the Americans are going to go on the offensive. Now, I want to say in passing that there's going to be a major American naval victory on Lake Erie, which is really going to help out the land forces. And we're going to go into a lot of detail about that in the next episode when we focus again on naval affairs. So suffice it to say for now that at the same time that things are going on that we're talking about in this episode, there's great naval victories for the Americans going on, especially Lake Erie. So the American victory on Lake Erie motivated General Proctor to withdraw his force to Burlington Heights, which is modern-day Hamilton in Ontario. This would make his supply line more secure. Meanwhile, General Harrison persuaded Kentucky Governor Isaac Shelby, who was known as Old King's Mountain because he had fought in that battle in the Revolution, to raise a force and march it to join him. That would be Harrison. Shelby brought 3,000 men to join Harrison, bringing Harrison's total force to about 5,500 men. A large number of Ohio volunteers also wanted to join, but they had to be turned away due to lack of supplies. There just wasn't enough. There weren't enough guns. There wasn't enough ammo. There wasn't enough food for all these people. But 5,500 is still a pretty good force. And in late September, Harrison marched to Detroit and occupied it. And he also occupied Fort Amherstburg. Then they crossed over the border into Canada. Their objective was Proctor's army. With the Americans gaining on him, Proctor deployed his force near Moraviantown, which is about 50 miles east of Detroit. He had 800 regulars, but only 600 who were fit for service, and he had about 500 Indians. So he's way outnumbered. Harrison's got far more men than Proctor and the British. On October 5th, Harrison marched 3,000 men towards Proctor's position. Part of his force was a cavalry regiment of 1,200 Kentuckians led by Colonel Richard M. Johnson. Johnson asked permission to lead his regiment in a frontal assault, and Harrison said yes. And the cavalry, shouting, "Remember the raisin," they charged into the enemy position and they routed the combined British and Indian force. In the battle, Tecumseh was killed. You know, and it's never been firmly established who exactly killed Tecumseh, but this Colonel Johnson that I mentioned earlier, he later claimed the credit. And this actually would take him all the way to the position of Vice President of the United States. This was in 1836. I'm going ahead a little bit, but it's just kind of an interesting piece of trivia. In 1836, when Martin Van Buren ran for president, he didn't pick, but the party picked Richard Johnson as his vice presidential candidate. And they had this saying, they said, "Rumpsy Dumpsy, Rumpsy Dumpsy, Colonel Johnson killed Tecumseh." So anyway, That's another little political slogan that was, it's kind of cute, but anyway, kind of brutal too.
So yeah, anyway, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly would not see that today. So in this battle, which was known as the Battle of the Thames, which named after the river that it occurred by, of course, that river is named after the famous British river in that goes through London. Anyway, the Canadians tend to refer this to the Battle of Moraviantown. The number killed and wounded was light on both sides, but the Americans captured 600 British soldiers. And of course, the loss of Tecumseh was a great blow to the Indians. He had been this uniting force that had worked so hard for so many years to bring these divided tribes together. And there's really not going to be somebody that steps up and replaces him. It's going to be hard to keep the Indians united and keep them fighting with the British. A lot of them are just going to go home and say, it's not my war. Anyway, now the Americans have a pretty good foothold into Upper Canada, and they threaten to take all of it in a month or two, although they had no plans to attempt this. Donald Hickey writes this, quote, British power and influence in the old Northwest was shattered beyond repair, and Tecumseh's Indian Confederacy was also shattered. Many Indians abandoned the British, end of quote. The British High Command suspended General Proctor, and he never had another command. But later, on May 14th, Harrison resigned. He resigned his commission. He just basically quit due to an ongoing conflict he had with Secretary of War Armstrong. And this would be the end of Harrison's involvement in the war. So Harrison, after winning this great victory, he's out. He's gone.
This is such a huge turnaround from a few episodes ago. I mean, basically, when we left it, the Western frontier, the Americans were more or less out of it, and now they're on top. I mean, and the British are out. I mean, this is disaster. One disaster befalls another disaster.
Yeah, you could say they're the two sides are taking turns having disasters. Yeah, this is a completely different situation. The Americans have turned the tables and are threatening to march much further into Upper Canada. At least there is the threat, the possibility.
And then Tecumseh's death, that's such an enormous blow. You have Brock that gets killed in action, and then Tecumseh. I mean, people debate the great man theory and all that, but you have to say in military, a strong commander, and we've seen it in this war, bad commanders wind up doing some pretty bad things a la Hull. And then you have Brock and Tecumseh who turn around all these battles. They're major blows.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Yes, and we always ask the question, what if, you know, us history nuts love to think about, what if Brock and Tecumseh had both survived? I think things would have gone much better for the British. I think the Americans would have been in big trouble. It's possible that the British might have taken all of the Michigan territory, for example, possibly even more. So, but we'll never know for sure.
No, we'll never know. What was Harrison and Armstrong's conflict? Does it really matter for this story?
It's not super important. It's interesting. I've spoken with Jerry Landry about this. Jerry Landry, of course, is the host of the Presidencies of the United States podcast, a very in-depth and excellent podcast. And he was saying that Armstrong really wanted to be the man out in the field. He wanted to be the general. He wanted glory. He wanted to lead the American troops on a conquering mission. But here he was stuck in Washington at a desk, and he was jealous of Harrison, basically. That was Jerry's theory on that, and I believe that sounds very reasonable. Armstrong was undercutting him. He had, after the Battle of the Thames, this great victory that Harrison won, Armstrong reassigned Harrison to a position further back in the rear, kind of a not a very prestigious position, certainly not on the front lines. And so Harrison just said, I've had enough. You know, their pride and honor was so important. It's hard for us to imagine today. I mean, they're still fairly important to people today. But back then, especially these military officers, they would just resign at the drop of a hat. They would have duels with each other. We'll be talking more about duels later. And just the slightest perceived insult could drive people to do things that we look back from our perspective and say, that was quite irrational. He should have just stuck it out. But he didn't.
Yeah, I think we would never consider a Secretary of War or a Secretary of Defense actually getting kitted out and hitting the battlefield. I mean, it seemed like that was even a kind of a preposterous proposition back then, too.
Yeah, for the most part. Although later we are going to see a Secretary of War do just that, but I will leave that teaser out there.
All right. So we're heading back over to the Niagara frontier, and the American Army, they're going to York, soon to be Toronto, but they're not going there to watch a game for the day. It's a little bit different situation. What's going on up in York?
Yeah, I have to mention that General Dearborn, who had not done well in 1812, was still in command here. And in an effort to weaken the British Navy's hold on Northern Lake Ontario, General Dearborn and Captain Isaac Chauncey, who I mentioned earlier, they decided to raid the Canadian city of York, which is present-day Toronto. York was the capital of Upper Canada and had a small Navy yard, and it only had 700 residents, so it was seen as pretty easy pickings. Again, for the mental map purposes, if you think of Lake Ontario, which is kind of shaped very roughly like an oval, it's very wide from east to west, not super wide north to south, at least not compared to east to west. It's still huge, but York is on the Canadian side. If you're thinking of a map, it's more on the left side, kind of the northwest part of Lake Ontario. And they're going to start from Oswego in New York State, which is across the lake on the southeast side. All right. So they're going to go, the ships with the men on them are going to move from Oswego to York, moving southeast to northwest. All right. And it happens on April 25th. Chauncey led a flotilla of ships from Sackett's Harbor. I said Oswego, but Sackett's Harbor to York. And the ships contained 1,800 soldiers and 800 seamen and Marines. York was defended by about 1,000 British troops commanded by General Sir Roger Sheaffe and about 100 Indians. On the 27th, the American landing force commanded by Brigadier General Zebulon Pike, there he is, they landed west of York. Supported by naval gunfire, they drove back the British force in a battle sometimes called Little York that cost the British 200 killed or wounded and 275 captured to about 310 killed and wounded for the Americans. Most of the Americans were killed by the explosion of the garrison's powder magazine. And when I say most of the Americans, I don't mean most of the ones that attacked. Most of the casualties the Americans suffered were caused by this explosion. The powder magazine is just an area where they keep gunpowder. Those are very dangerous. Sheaffe had ordered this destroyed during the retreat. General Pike was one of those killed in the explosion. So General Pike, we hardly knew you. Farewell. Thank you for your service.
Fare thee well,
yeah, and he was still very young, too. When the infuriated American soldiers reached the city of York, they thoroughly sacked the city and they set fire to all the government buildings. So the American capture of the city of York was a major victory, especially since American sailors seized one vessel and tried to seize a second one, but was destroyed by the British. This helped the Americans keep the balance of power on Lake Ontario, and it may have hindered British control of Lake Erie, since many British supplies intended to be sent to Lake Erie were destroyed or fell into American hands.
Yeah, all of the supplies would have had to have gone, if they were coming from Montreal and those places, they'd have to come down the St. Lawrence River, go across Lake Ontario, and then be portaged to the old Northwest. Mm-hmm. So that's a key location, is where Toronto is, basically, to get supplies from back east to the frontier zone.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's a really interesting little mini story on the sort of the Paul Revere of Canada. They call her Laura Secord. She was actually one of these late loyalist Americans who had come to Canada from Massachusetts. And I think it was her dad ran a boarding house in Queenston, and she overheard some American officers talking about a plan. And she went all throughout the Niagara frontier telling all of the commanders that this big attack was coming. And she's sort of a national hero in Canada, even to this day.
Interesting. I was not aware of her story. That's fascinating. So she was an American, but she, I guess, sympathized with the British, huh?
Yeah, they had lived there, I want to say, right after the Revolution, mm-hmm. or right at approximately that time. So I believe She was born in the U.S., but lived in Canada, and that's where her, and I believe she married a guy who was in the Canadian-British military, so that, you know, at that point, they're fully British, and that kind of feeds into some of this other action that's going on in the Niagara, so a little bit further south of York.
Right. Okay.
Slash Toronto.
Yeah, I have to say, too, one other thing, this burning of so much of the city of York really made the British upset. It's kind of, they saw that as going beyond the pale. That's just too much. It's one thing to take our city, but don't burn it, for crying out loud. And they're going to be looking for revenge in the future.
So what were some of these other actions going around and things going on in battles in this general area?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of small or relatively small engagements. So we'll go through these kind of quickly. So we'll start at Fort George. Again, Fort George is in the southwest part of Lake Ontario, and it's obviously it's on the Canadian side and it's on the Niagara River. Across the river on the American side is Fort Niagara. So the Americans are going to go to take Fort George. In fact, they marched a force of about 4,000. They started bombarding the fort, and with supporting naval fire, an American force under Winfield Scott last landed west of the fort. The fort's defenders came out to meet the Americans, but they were quickly overwhelmed. The British abandoned the fort, which fell to the Americans. This exposed British positions all along the Niagara, so the British general in charge, General Vincent, ordered the evacuation of the other British positions in the area. That includes Chippewa, Queenston, and Fort Erie. The Americans now controlled the entire Niagara frontier, but Vincent still held Burlington Heights, the western end of Lake Ontario, with about 1,600 men or so. Then we moved to Sackett's Harbor. This was the naval base. It's an American naval base on Lake Ontario. It's the place from which the attack on York had originated. And on May 28th, in retaliation for the burning of York and the capture of Fort George, British General Prevost led a 1,000-man raid on the American naval base there, Sackett's Harbor. The British had supporting fire from two gunboats, but the American Defense Force, commanded by Brigadier General Jacob Brown, was larger and well-based, well-placed, so they drove the British off. But this is kind of crazy. An American naval officer who thought the British were winning the battle, that they were going to take the harbor, he ordered the burning of the naval yard. They're not even really losing. It's, oh, just in, we're losing. Let's burn it. The Americans managed to put out the flames before any major damage was done to the harbor, but many crucial supplies were destroyed. The British, thinking they had destroyed the harbor, returned to Canada. So there you go, tit for tat, you burn us, we burn you. Now let's look at Stony Creek. In early June, General Dearborn marched 2,500 men toward the British position at Burlington Heights that I mentioned earlier. But before dawn on June 5th, a British force of only 750 men surprised the Americans, killing the sentries and capturing the American artillery. The two American commanders were also captured, and the Americans had to retreat. Dearborn ordered all American forces to concentrate at Fort George for better security. The British, in turn, established several outposts near the fort. So they still control Fort George, again, which is on the British and Canadian side, but had a little pushback here from the British. Then in late June, an American force of about 600 marched to attack a nearby British outpost at Beaver Dams. They were ambushed by a combined British-Indian force. The British commander borrows a page out of good old General Brock's playbook, and he exaggerates the size of the Indian force, and the Americans just surrendered. Say, I've got hundreds, thousands of Indians. Oh, okay, we give up. American politicians were obviously furious, and General Dearborn was finally removed from command. So that's the last of the three older men who were in charge at the very beginning in the north. Then Fort George is going to go under siege. In early July, the British and Indians laid siege to the fort. They also raided nearby American posts. By December, the American position had deteriorated. Many of the garrison had been transferred to the east, leaving only 250 men to defend the fort. The soldiers had not been paid for months, and they were living in tents. Because of this, the fort's commander, Brigadier General George McClure, ordered the fort's evacuation on December 10th, 1813. McClure ordered the burning of the nearby town of Newark, but not the fort. And then we go to Fort Niagara. And again, here's more retaliation. The sides need to just quit burning down each other's settlements. In retaliation for the burning of Newark, the British attacked and captured Fort Niagara on the American side of the river. The Americans lost 80 killed or wounded, 350 captured, plus a great deal of weaponry, ammunition, and other supplies. And the British would hold this fort until the end of the war. Then finally, after the capture of Fort Niagara, a British force crossed into American territory and destroyed Lewiston and several other towns. Then on December 30th, the British force looted and burned the American towns of Black Rock and Steve's hometown of Buffalo. So a lot of, you know, back and forth. It's like a seesaw battle or seesaw war, basically. Donald Hickey summarizes it this way. He says, thus, by the end of the year, the Niagara frontier was in flames and the American position along the entire front had collapsed.
Yeah, so we're really looking here at a wave of up and down, up and down, up and down of disaster, comebacks, disasters from right. Both the British and the Americans.
Yeah, I mean, the American situation was very promising for a while, but it's just I don't want to say stalemate necessarily. There is some movement. There's some a bit back and forth. It, like I said, it's a seesaw game.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
I think that a lot of this, you start to see that difference between the populace and the militia versus the regular army. I had done some reading about that time period. The people were at Fort Niagara, the militia were horrified that McClure burned Newark. Newark was a town the people visited. They had friends and family who lived in Newark. And I think that must have really crushed morale, especially knowing that the British were definitely going to come and burn Lewiston. And then, every single settlement on the American side was fair game once you burn down one of their cities.
Yeah, it just keeps escalating and getting uglier and uglier. And eventually the British are going to burn something even more important, but I will leave.
That's a foreshadowing. I also don't really understand why McClure would burn the town, but not Fort George, which is a bizarre decision.
Maybe he wanted to take and hold the fort. That would be.
Yeah. And then a big part of the problem is that Fort Niagara was never really built to be a fort, per se. Mm-hmm. It's still extant today. You can go see it. The French built it, which you had talked about in the previous episode. It's a huge, imposing building there. It looks like a French chateau, but it's very low compared to the other side, the Canadian side. You can see into Fort Niagara from, you don't even have to be at Fort George, which is even higher up and on higher land. So, I mean, the Americans were never in a very good position to begin with there.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that. So how does the burning of Buffalo make you feel?
I mean, it's definitely a part of local lore growing up in Buffalo. Black Rock and Buffalo, Black Rock's now eventually would become incorporated into Buffalo inside of the city limits. But, where I grew up, and even I don't live there anymore, but where the town I lived in just outside of Buffalo, that's where one of the major encampments was, the major encampment. Winfield Scott's house was about a block. It's not there anymore, but the location of the house that he worked out of was just about a block from my house. The playground where my kids played there, that's where the Army hospital was. And there's some still, people will dig up in their backyard and find bullets and cannonballs. So, I mean, that was a pretty cool part of local history.
Oh, fascinating. I can imagine just playing in the backyard. Oh, look, here's a bullet from 1812, 1813. Wow. So far, well, I'm just going to wrap up and say the Americans are 1-1. Okay. So they did some good things and won some victories in the old Northwest, in Upper Canada, at least the western part of Upper Canada. But this is definitely not a victory for the Americans. So, where are we going to go next?
Yeah, we're kind of like a yo-yo. We keep going up and down, back and forth, and ups and downs and victories and losses and geography too. Now we have to swing back over to Montreal again.
Right. So we're going east. Well, Secretary Armstrong, after a while, decided that the time was right for an attack on Montreal. And we're going to bring in some new blood here. So the overall commander of the expedition to take Montreal would be General James Wilkinson. And he is one of the most slimy snakes in all of American history, most colorful characters, but colorful in a bad way. Well, I'll talk about him some more in just a minute. Another key commander was General Wade Hampton, who was supposed to be under Wilkinson's command, but who despised him and would not take orders from him. So there we go again, Steve, this theme that keeps recurring throughout this war of commanders that didn't like each other and refused to cooperate. Let's talk about James Wilkinson. Wilkinson was born in Maryland in 1757, and he joined the Continental Army in 1775. During the war, he served on the staffs of Nathaniel Greene, Benedict Arnold, and Horatio Gates. To say the least, he was a schemer, and he was twice forced to resign for incompetence. He later rejoined the Army and served under Mad Anthony Wayne, with whom he feuded, of course, at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, which was in 1794. In 1805, Wilkinson became the territorial governor of New Orleans. And while in that position, he became a secret agent for the Spanish. Yes, it is true. He was literally taking a monthly stipend from the Spanish. And that wasn't enough. He became involved with Aaron Burr's conspiracy to establish an independent nation in the Southwest. Wilkinson later turned against Burr, testifying against him in court. He mismanaged the Louisiana Territory so badly, and he was hated by nearly all. Of Wilkinson, the historian Frederick Jackson Turner said he was, quote, the most consummate artist in treason that the nation ever possessed, end quote. And Winfield Scott once wrote that, quote, serving under Wilkinson was like being married to a prostitute, end quote. Oh, my. So how about that, Steve? Really, really upstanding guy, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let's see if he's better at commanding armies in the field than he is of just being a good person. So here's the plan. The plan was for Wilkinson to lead an army from Sackett's Harbor westward along the St. Lawrence River toward Montreal, while Hampton would bring his force northward from Plattsburgh, New York. So Hampton sets off, on September 19th, Hampton and his army began their march heading to Montreal. After much delay and problems with militia, his force of 3,800 encountered a Canadian Indian force of nearly 2,000. On October 26th, the two sides clashed at the Chateauguay River. Casualties were light, but Hampton became convinced that the attack had failed and he retreated. So how about that? You've got almost double your opponent's forces, but you just lose the nerve and you bug out. So good job, Hampton.
Yes.
And Wilkinson doesn't really know this, and he's like counting on Hampton to participate and to hit Montreal from a different direction, but that's not going to happen. Meanwhile, Wilkinson got sick with dysentery. To treat it, he took great quantities of laudanum, which made him drunk and unfit for command. Laudanum is basically opium dissolved in water and maybe some other stuff put in there. So Wilkinson is a little bit loopy, but despite this, he did not cede his command. He didn't hand it over to someone who was not drunk, basically, and on drugs. So Wilkinson leads his army of 7,300 from Sackett's Harbor down the river, encountering many obstacles and delays on the way. He sent Brigadier General John Boyd with 3,000 to attack a British force at Chrysler's Ford on the northern bank of the river southwest of Montreal. Boyd mismanaged the battle, and the British force soundly defeated the Americans. That is going to be it, pretty much. Wilkinson ordered his army into winter quarters. He did try in March 1814 one more attack at La Colle Mill, but that also failed. And so that is the end of the Montreal campaign. Listeners, raise your glasses. Once again, it is an unmitigated disaster. It was a total failure. Wilkinson was soon removed from command, and his career was over. Hampton resigned, and a number of younger officers, including Jacob Brown and Winfield Scott, were promoted and given more authority.
There's no mixed battles here. It's all either big wins or big losses.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we saw one that was kind of a stalemate, but yeah, for the most part. And they're so amazing to me. These commanders often have so little will to fight, so little perseverance.
Yeah, they just immediately throw in the towel. I mean, in some cases, they threw in the towel before they even got a chance to give it a try.
Exactly. Yeah, it's hard to fathom. But
And then Wilkinson, I mean, how did this guy keep going year after year after year when, I mean, did they just not realize he was as slimy as he was? And this is something that didn't really come out until later. I mean, it seemed like some people had a good read on him.
Yeah, he really was the Teflon general. He just had very good diplomatic skills. He was very persuasive. He had a way of ingratiating himself. He was a flatterer, you know, that kind of person. It was a survivor. You know, the whole thing with Aaron Burr, when it looked like they were going to get caught, he stabs Burr in the back and throws him under the bus. So, yeah, it's a remarkable long, long career of somebody who does whatever it takes to get to the top and does whatever it takes to survive, even when he gets in trouble. It's pretty amazing. You have to kind of give him some grudging respect.
Yeah, a little tiny bit.
A tiny bit, right. Yeah. Okay. All right, any final thoughts on this? It's things went a little better than 1812, but not too much better.
No, we're still, this is a hard slog of a war we're going through here.
It really is. The Americans are not making progress, really. Not any real progress. Well, all right. So that wraps up our discussion of the 1813 American invasion of Canada. And in our next episode, we are going to talk about some more naval warfare. What does the U.S. Navy do in 1813? Can they repeat a lot of their stunning victories of 1812? Or are the British going to kind of rise to the occasion and slap this fly, so to speak, and knock him away and put the Americans back in their place? Show them who's boss. Tune in next time, and you will find out.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen, and Vlogging Through History by Chris Mowry. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you could join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Anna Concepcion Castro, Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabrese, Alex Coombs, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Mike Rollison, David Santee, and Michael Severino. And to Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Roger Douglas, Scott Hendricks, Hoosier Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.